Pittsburgh, I love ya. This is Brian Edward, and you're listening to Berg Vivant, Pittsburgh's cultural talk magazine, delivered digitally, straight up, shaken, and stirred. Tonight's broadcast brought to you by our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Zafalo's Banquet and Event Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, one of the most beautiful and unique venues in the greater Pittsburgh area for weddings, corporate dinners, fundraisers, and more. Visit clubzafalo.com. Off the Wall Theater, enlivening, educating, and entertaining audiences in the Pittsburgh region. View their current season at insideoffthewall.com. Arcade Comedy Theater, hosting local and national comedians, sketch comedy, improv, and more. 811 Liberty Avenue, downtown. Be sure to like them on Facebook or find them at arcadecomedytheater.com. Berg Vivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. You can learn more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. Eric Singer, engineer, inventor, the brains behind SingerBots, which
yes.
are robots that play musical instruments.
More so, actually, they are robots that are musical instruments.
Oh.
Because when you say robots that play musical instruments, people think of Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah.
Teddy bears playing the banjo.
Right, like right. So you must look at like Country Bear Jamboree and think to yourself, amateurs.
Well, I mean, it's from the beginning, it is not the approach that I've ever wanted to take. I wanted to create new kinds of musical instruments. And that's evolved, and I've relaxed that somewhat because I've had people come to me for commissions who've wanted particular kinds of instruments, drums and percussion, band instruments and mallets, those kinds of things. But the first instrument that I created, and this is one string out of what are usually four, this is a string from the GuitarBot, and it doesn't look like a guitar. And it doesn't look like a robot, so I have a lot of nerve calling it a musical robot anyway. But it plays by sliding back and forth. It's different from any guitar, and it's different from the way any person plays. So there you go. It's a new way of making music. The reason it's on the table like this right now is that I am in the process of making version 3. I made the original one in 2002. I made the second one, Mark II, if you will, for Pat Metheny in 2009. And now I'm making Model 3, given the additional things that I know and the additional tools that I have in my arsenal to make a better instrument. One that will last longer, be more accurate, all of those sorts of things.
And this is truly unique. I mean, is there anyone else in the world that's working quite like this right now?
You know, there are about half a dozen or so, maybe at this point a dozen or so, quote, musical roboticists in the world, people whose primary work it is to create robotic musical instruments, and not just one-offs. You'll often see kind of cool instruments come out of labs from Japanese universities, but like sort of one-offs. But there are a few people who do this, just do it in their own style. So this is my style of musical robots.
And you have an extensive background in art and music, so this is a beautiful way to blend the technological know-how with the engineering with art, really, in a way.
Yeah, it is. I did not call myself an artist for a long time until my group, which we can go into in a little bit, when we started showing our work in galleries and museums, I went, I guess I'm an artist now as well. And people shy away from that term because it's sort of had this guise of pretension for a long time, but it is a career, and it's my career, and it's sort of one facet of my career. So I'm an artist, I'm a musician, I'm a programmer, I'm an engineer, I'm a bunch of different kinds of engineers, things that I've had to learn along the way. I'm sort of the worst, most horrible kind of DIY guy who just has to do everything himself.
Well, that is DIY, right? So you'd be, that would probably make you the greatest DIY guy, wouldn't it?
yes, though I have learned over the years, and I've kind of taught myself to incorporate other people into the work. And even from the beginning, when I started Lemur, which is the group that I started in 2000 to create robotic musical instruments, I was bringing other artists and other technologists and musicians and people under the fold and incorporating their ideas. And then as the installations and the work got bigger and grander, there was really no choice but to start bringing in apprentices and interns and people like that. And I don't say that as being a bad thing. I say that as actually being a very good thing. It allowed us to expand the work, and it also allowed us to train this whole large group of people in the art of machining and electronics and all of the skills around that.
Pittsburgh seems to have a pretty active tech scene. You know, is that what brought you to the city?
Well, I went to Carnegie Mellon. I didn't grow up here. I grew up on the East Coast, born in New York, consider myself a New Yorker. Born, not bred, because I grew up in Connecticut, but I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. What brought me to Pittsburgh, right? I went to CMU. From there, I went to Boston, went to Berklee College of Music, got a second bachelor's degree there, essentially. In music synthesis. And I had a professor there who sort of pushed me in this direction and said, well, you know, you can combine these things and you can make a career out of it. So from there, I moved to New York and went to NYU, got a master's in computer science, worked at a multimedia lab there while I was in school, and was then in New York for 15 years. I never thought I would be there that long. I thought I was going to love grad school and hate New York and then just get out. But I ended up loving New York. So I stayed there for 15 years. Then it got really expensive and confining and artistically confining, because if you're spending all your time worrying about making money and being cramped into small spaces and all of that, you have less time to make art. So it was kind of a natural, like a no-brainer, to come back to Pittsburgh, which is Robot City. I had contacts, still have contacts at Carnegie Mellon, knew some people in the area, and the cost of living is much lower, and the amount of space that you get is much larger. So although I'm in the process of moving to another house, the house I've been living in has a basement that is large enough to put my full shop. The house that I'm moving to has a garage that will be my my shop. So I can do everything that I was doing in like a 1,000 square feet in New York, in about 500 square feet in Pittsburgh, sort of streamlined the whole process. And, you know, I'm talking about having more space, but now I'm using less. But then, there's I have my electronics lab upstairs. I have other shops in the city if I need other places to work. I have contacts who can get things done for me if I need a particular part made, you know, that sort of stuff. So there are more resources available to me here, and really it's also easier to get your work out there, out into the world in Pittsburgh. You're not kind of competing with just sort of this. You're sort of competing with yourself in New York and all this noise and life. It was great. I learned how to do all of this stuff in New York. I did a lot of amazing art. I'd like to say I got everything that I could out of New York. Now, Pittsburgh was just a great next progression for me.
So where do you begin with a SingerBot? And what's the process of making one? I mean, let's take GuitarBot, for example,
right,
because we have a piece of him, is it appropriate to say, here in front of us?
Him, her, it. Various people have called it different things. It depends on if you want to anthropomorphize it or not. Mari Kimura, a violinist that I worked with in New York, she liked to call them Mr. 1 through Mr. 4 for each of the strings. And she'd say, how is Mr. 2 today? Because Mr. 2 was always having problems. So she thought it was a him. Could be. Whatever.
So where do you begin? You have a concept for maybe an instrument, or do you start with the music, or what's the first step to putting one of these together?
Well, let's take the GuitarBot. I'm a saxophone player, so I decided that the first instrument I should make is a guitar. Why?
Well, the wind instruments are probably tough, because you've got to get like air compressors involved, maybe.
Yeah. In a sense, I don't want to say it was an arbitrary decision, but I've always loved guitar and have sort of been a frustrated guitar player, and always sort of had this idea in my mind of like an automated guitar, and I don't know why. The first musical instrument that I ever made, like a lot of kids did, was a shoebox guitar. You take the shoebox, you cut a hole in it, you make a little bridge out of cardboard, mm-hmm. you stretch the rubber band across, and din 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 din. So it's a sort of funny coming full circle thing.
Come a long way from that shoebox guitar.
Right. So, it just seemed like an interesting challenge, and it seemed like a unique instrument. I didn't want to make one with frets because it seemed, I don't exactly know why. I just sort of had, you know, a lot of ideas, like, you know, with creative people just sort of spring forth from your mind. Mm. And I thought, robotic slide to control the pitch, that might be cool. And let's see if we can do that. And I really had no idea where to start. When I founded the group in 2000 in Brooklyn, I gathered a bunch of people together. I really went around to a bunch of my friends and colleagues, and I said, hey, do you want to make musical robots? And a bunch of them said yes.
Wow, cool friends.
And yeah. I had a lot of cool friends in New York, a lot of great artists. And, you know, I learned a lot from them. And I hope they learned some things from me. And so formed some great collaborations there. And so we had this group of people together. And I thought, well, this is great. We have all of these skills, you know, electrical engineering and programming. And people understand music and acoustics and sculpture and all of that kind of stuff. Mm. But what we didn't have were mechanical or robotic engineers.
Mm.
So I didn't see this as an obstacle, it for some reason, just maybe a challenge. And what I did was I emailed the head of a company in New York called Honeybee Robotics, and I said, hi, I'm this guy, and I'm trying to make musical robots. And maybe you could send an email around to the engineers in your company and see if anyone's interested.
What was their immediate reply to that? Were they like, oh, sure? Were they like, I don't know?
No, he loved the idea.
Wow, you know? That's great.
He was like, yeah, that sounds cool. So he sent this email around, and two guys from the company emailed me back and joined the group. And we got started actually working over at their company after hours, just, you know, experimenting and building things on machines that I had never seen before, had no idea what they were, things like milling machines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
was that what that is? I thought that was to make cappuccino.
Yes, it actually does have a cappuccino attachment.
Right.
It makes great cappuccino, espresso, but when you're not making coffee, it's really good for making robots.
Ah, very good.
So, you know, we started working with these guys, and then I applied for a grant to the Rockefeller Foundation, and we got the grant, and we were really excited. We could start building all of these instruments and buy materials and all this kind of stuff. And then the robotics guys quit because they got busy with work. Because this company does, I don't even know if they still exist, but they were doing contracts for NASA and things like that. In fact, they had the coolest thing that I've ever seen in a 5-gallon bucket. There was a bucket sitting in the shop, and on the side of it said Lunar Simulant. And they were making core drills for the moon.
You know, that's amazing, because I was going to ask you, what's the most amazing thing you've ever seen in a 5-gallon bucket? Unbelievably, you beat me to it.
I anticipated that question. great. So now we had this grant, and, you know, all of these people excited with ideas, and no one who knew the first thing about robotics, really. So we started to learn. We talked to friends and other people who were building machines, who were making robotic art. There was an artist in New York that I had met that was making not musical robots, but art that moved, essentially, kinetic sculptures.
Sure.
And we did sort of a little trade for service where I helped him with electronics and he taught me how to mill and taught me about a mill. And then we had some money, so we bought a mill. And then we started figuring out how you cut metal, what you can do with it, how you can put a slot in a piece of metal, which is a really important thing to be able to do when you are creating robots. Just the skill of being able to cut and shape metal, as it gets easier and easier to do these sorts of things and to do 3D printing and make things of kind of any shape and size and variety, I think people start to take these things for granted. But from the beginning, I didn't even know how to attach something to a motor. So I had to learn all of these things myself. And it took a really long time. And the first 2 years of the group really was just spent playing around on the mill, playing around with motors, looking around at other devices and things that worked in similar ways that I wanted these mechanisms to work. And if this is disassembled now, but if you look at this belt on the guitar bot, it is essentially a scanner or inkjet printer type mechanism. Mm-hmm. So, well, you know, the carriage slides back and forth, so aha, there's how you make something slide. So, okay, now where do you get the parts to do that?
Man.
So then it was into, this is early in the internet, so not everything was online. So you had these industrial catalogs that were this thick,
yeah,
that had 5,000 pages in it. And not to be crude or anything, but I kept copies of them in my bathroom and in my free time. I would, you know, anytime I had free time, I was looking in these catalogs, figuring out things like, well, what, you know, what, how do you specify a screw? What sizes do screws come in? What are the standards for those? What are the standards for gears? How do you attach gears to motors? These kinds of things. Wow. And, you know, after a couple of years, we had built the prototype to GuitarBot 1. Meanwhile, we had a bunch of other artists in the group who were working on other different projects. One that was kind of like a clamshell that opened up and had a rattle inside. So it would go like this, and the rattle would come out and like that. So a couple of motorized mechanisms. One that had these stalks with egg shakers on the end, and then at the bottom there was a shaker motor that would rattle them and they would sway back and forth. So a lot of different kinds of ideas. And what we were doing was teaching each other, and you know, here's the cool idea I'm working on. You know, how do I do this? Well, why don't you try it this way? And then, you know, also on the machines, teaching each other how to do different operations on the mill and accomplish the kinds of things you need to when you're building things out of metal.
And now, Singer bots are getting all around the world, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Is that primarily through commission work, or
yes, yeah, it has been. In the earlier days of Lemur, we were kind of doing everything. We were doing museum installations. We were doing live performances with various musicians, some up and coming, some well known.
So like a duet between a musician and a singer bot?
Yes, though it was a Lemur bot.
A Lemur bot,
back
sure,
then.
Sure.
So yes, in fact, you can find video of one of the early duets. I mentioned Mari Kimura before. She wrote a duet for violin and guitar bot. And one of the things that was unique about this piece is that it was actually mostly software that was mitigating the process of this duet. So she had written not just music to the piece for the violin, but software that would listen to the violin, the computer doing a listening process, mm-hmm, analyze what she was doing, and then make the guitar bot react to that.
Wow.
Now, it wasn't just copying her playing exactly what she was doing. There were certain rules. So if she played perhaps, you know, long notes, it might play high notes. If she played short notes, it might play low notes, or it might slide back and forth. There are a whole lot of different rules and different progressions of rules throughout the piece.
So it was sort of spontaneous, I mean, from the guitar bot's point of view, because everything it was doing was based off her, rather than it being programmed from the get-go to play this note at this time.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what you call interactive music. And back then, you could say, oh, I do interactive art, and it meant something very specific. Mm. And now if you say I do interactive art, it could mean that you design web pages. But,
yeah,
you know, back then it meant something very specific, and what it meant was computer mitigated interaction between humans and musical instruments, video, synthesizers, all of that sort of stuff. So that, you know, that's interactive music. It's also algorithmic composition or algorithmic improvisation. An algorithm is just kind of a fancy word for a program, or the, you know, the method of the way a program works, software. So that's a whole other area of work, and that could be done with musical robots, mm-hmm, could be done with synthesizers, it can be done with a piano. You know, in fact, you can have put a set of rules on paper in front of someone and say, instead of sheet music, you say, follow these rules within these certain parameters, give them leeway in there. And the leeway in software is an element of randomness, or bringing data in from other sources like the weather or the alignment mm-hmm. of the planets or whatever. Wow. And people have done all kinds of, crazy stuff, doing body sensing, doing sensing movement, sensing the, and this just becomes more and more common. The way your cell phone works, that can be turned into a musical instrument. You can, and of course it has been, there's tons of musical programs. Had I been given a cell phone type device 10 years ago, I would have freaked out. I would have said, this is the most amazing thing, and just basically start to turn gestures mm-hmm. into sound, into music, wow. whether that's for robots or whether it's for synthesized sound.
So now there is, or will be shortly, a singer bot that will be essentially the opening act at the Lido in Paris, one of the most famous entertainment nightclubs in Paris. Is this true?
Yes. And in fact, what it is, and what I call it, because I see it as a natural progression of sort of what past work, what the history of the art has been, is I call it an orchestrion. Orchestrions, people started building them in the 1800s, kind of in earnest, but certainly automated instruments have existed for hundreds and hundreds of years. So, orchestrions became popular in the 1800s, and they were sort of very elaborate player pianos, but they had other types of instruments. So you would have that piano reel kind of thing, and you'd have all of these mechanical instruments. So now, what is an orchestrion? It's a roboticized set of musical instruments. So the orchestrion, the Lido orchestrion, as I call it, is a collection of about 40 to 50 different instruments.
Wow.
It actually has about 150 mechanisms that could possibly play at the same time. That would be somewhat cacophonous. But the mechanism count gets very high because there are four xylophones, different types of xylophones in this orchestrion, and every note on every xylophone has its own mechanism.
Mm.
And then, there are drums and cymbals and shakers and exotic percussion, Latin percussion, all of those kinds of things.
So not only something to listen to, but something to watch. I imagine seeing this on a stage is pretty incredible.
Absolutely. I mean, there's that cool factor. There's the visual factor. It's visual art as well as sound art and music. And I don't deny that there's this whizzy factor to it. But I'll also say that it's a lot more interesting to watch these instruments play than to watch the back of, the glowing icon logo on the back of someone's computer while they type a performance. The sort of typical DJ mode thing. That's one thing. But there was a period where that was the aesthetic, where everyone was making music by putting a laptop on stage.
Well, right, and it's hard to dazzle us now, but this really takes it to a whole new level, to the fact that, this is the opening act. It's not a comedian or a dancer, it's
an
orchestrion.
Exactly.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lido, and boom, curtain goes up, and there's this thing on stage, right?
Yeah, exactly. Wow. And because it is really a collection of musical instruments, it's a tableau, it's a blank slate, really. It can play anything that's composed for it.
Does it take requests?
If someone has written the music for the request, yes, certainly. But they are going to be writing 100 songs. The composers at the Lido are going to be writing 100 songs for it over the next 10 years.
That's right. It got a 10-year contract at the Lido to be the opening act at the Lido for 10 years. I don't think Bette Midler even got that in Vegas.
Yeah. Well, it's not that I got a 10-year contract. It's just that I actually heard this very late in the game, they hired me to build this particular set of instruments. So I was contracted to do that. And then as I was installing it during that process, which took a couple of weeks, I heard, oh, this show is going to run for 10 years. And it is this opener to a new show. They change their show, as I understand it, about every 10 years. And they hired Franco Dragone, who is historically was one of the early designers of Cirque du Soleil, did a lot of their early productions. So he was hired by the Lido to produce a new show for them. And his company contacted me and said, we want this orchestrion to open the night. And we talked back and forth, what do you want in it? And, you know, what's your vision for it? And they had sort of a visual idea for it. In particular, their, you know, head lead composer wanted certain instruments in there. And so we came to an agreement and a conclusion, and I started building them.
So the orchestrion is from Pittsburgh, built here, right?
Yes, built here with the help of Pittsburgh talent. Pittsburgh machinists and manufacturing people, and people who help with assembly and fabrication and all of this kind of stuff. People that I found through a program called Made Right Here, which the whole point of the program is to put people to work back in manufacturing, because we've lost a lot of manufacturing in the U.S. And Pittsburgh, you know, of course, had a grand manufacturing tradition here. All the steel came out of here. And so what are you going to do when you have a whole ton of steel? Well, ton. When you have a million tons of steel, you're going to manufacture with it. And then, you know, we all know the story behind that. That industry died. A lot of it went overseas. A lot of the manufacturing from the areas went overseas. True throughout the country. People in Pittsburgh have realized this over the last few years that, you know, this area, this region can become a hub of manufacturing again. And because of all of the new manufacturing tools and automation and 3D printing and kind of contract shops and places where you can go and learn manufacturing and get manufacturing done. Well, that's, you know, that's what I did, because I had 4 months to build this, and I knew that there was no way I was building this thing myself in 4 months. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
What is it like for you when you complete something like that and switch it on? I mean, I replace a lighting fixture and I feel like a god. You know, so I can't imagine what that is like.
It's funny. It's sort of a difficult thing when you're so inside of this work, and really you just have to work and work and work until it's done. And, you know, I will never not finish a job, and I will never not end with something that doesn't work if I'm hired to do something. I don't know any other way to do things. And that's not by way of bragging. It's just, I guess, the way I've always learned, the way I, you know, the way I was brought up is you start a project and, you know, you're hired to do something and you finish it. So I work as hard as I need to get that job done. So I'm so inside of the work for a really long time. I'm so focused on it. And then it's done. And at, you know, at the end you're doing tweaks and things like that. So it's not quite done. And it's not like, you know, at the end you flip a switch and the light comes on and ta-da. It's, you know, you're getting, you know, almost everything working, and then you're going and then tweaking stuff and adjusting things in software and all this stuff. So it's kind of like, whoosh, right? And then, well, I guess, whoosh, you know, then it sort of levels off. and I'm probably going out of camera at this point. And then it's sort of like at the end of a race when you're kind of coming to a stop. And then maybe you look back at the race course and you go, you know, wow, I just did that. So it's only, you know, at the very end when you can relax a little bit and hand it off and see other people use it. And that's true with all of my instruments. I do create music, but I mostly improvise. I don't compose so much. So I've always brought in a lot of composers and musicians to work with the instruments. Also, I wanted a lot of different kinds of music done with the instruments. I didn't want just one style, so I brought in musicians of all different styles. What's the point? The point is that until I get to stand back and watch someone else use the work, I don't get to really fully appreciate it. Hmm. And then when I see someone else using it, besides the fact that I get very nervous about something breaking, and it honestly, it rarely ever does because I've spent a long time figuring out why things break. Hmm. And also, you can't have things fail in performance. I'm not going to claim that this is the same thing. Like, you can't have machines fail in a medical environment. Mm-hmm. I guess you can have things fail in performance and not have someone die, but it's the conductor maybe has a heart attack. it's the show must go on kind of thing. And my metric all along was the worst thing that should happen to one of my instruments should be equivalent to a string breaking on a guitar. Or a saxophonist breaking his reed, though that usually doesn't happen unless you bang it into the wall or something like that. I haven't broken many reeds as a saxophone player, so I don't know why I use that as an example. But it's that sort of thing. You shouldn't have catastrophic failure. And I watched a lot of early performances where people were pushing the bounds, and I understood what they were trying to do with electronic music, but you would watch people get on stage with a computer and maybe a new kind of instrument that they had built and spend 20 minutes fiddling when they're supposed to be performing, checking wires and trying to figure out why things didn't work. And I'm just like, if we want people to accept these new instruments as legitimate, as a legitimate art form, you got to be able to switch them on and they have to work right away.
So has the Orchestrion debuted yet at the Lido?
It has. It debuted in the beginning of April, and I got to see some of the first performances.
Hey, all right.
And then I flew home. And
how'd it go over? How'd the crowd like it?
The crowd loved it, and they all come forward because it's on the same level as the audience. Mm-hmm. And it actually plays during dinner. It's kind of like the not the pit orchestra, but it's like the jazz band that entertains during dinner.
Wow.
Or that sort of thing. So people will get up from their chairs and they'll come over to see what the thing is, because you can see things moving. If you're far away, you might not exactly know what's going on, but you're seeing music, you're hearing music come from this, and you're seeing things move, and you're like, well, what the hell's going on here? And then you get closer to it and you realize that everything on it is automated. Hmm. And then you have this just like, whoa, wow, that's really cool moment. And I still have those moments, especially with the guitar bot, because I've worked on it so much and because it's so complicated of an instrument, that sometimes I'll be watching a performance with it, watching someone else perform on it, and just go, I can't believe that's working.
So you built it well, I think is what that means, right?
So it's, well, it gets better and better. The first version, it didn't work unless Eric was there with it. Unless I was, if I was setting it up and I was adjusting things and all of that kind of stuff every single time. And the next version, it could go on the road. And actually, two of them did with Pat Metheny. And that is that's a really actually very good example of the show must go on kind of situation. Pat Metheny, for those who don't know, is a famous jazz guitar player, Grammy-winning guitar player. He came to me in 2008. This is when I was still working as Lemur in New York. And he said, I want to tour the world with an automated band as my backup band, as my group. And I said, we can do that. And so he told us, he told me what kinds of instruments he wanted in this. And he wanted specific mallet instruments and specific drums and cymbals and a couple of guitar bots and various other kinds of things. And then he was going to tour the world in 2010, which he actually, in fact, did. But looking out from the beginning of 2009, a year ahead, you don't hand a Grammy winner a whole pile of instruments that is going to fail when he's on tour. So that I wouldn't have agreed to that job if I didn't feel confident that we could pull it off. And it was all building on previous work. And I knew that I had instruments in installation for several months before. And we made design adjustments. Part of the process of working on these instruments is very often I'll design them in the computer in a CAD program, computer aided design program. So I'm designing the instrument as a picture, a 3D picture, and I can move things around, all that sort of stuff. And then I will machine it, or we will machine it as a group, or I will hire people to build it. And then you test it out, and you go, oh, well, all right, this worked, this didn't work, whatever. And you go back to the computer, and then you iterate, and then you make changes to the instrument, and you go back and forth in this process. So, I'd spent years doing that, and iterating the designs and making them better and better. So when he came to me it was at the end of 2008, I was confident that we could do this. And then he took them on the road, toured with them all through 2010, through Europe, North America, and Asia. And at the end of the tour, I said, how did it go? How did they work? And he said, your instruments were the least of our problems.
Wow.
So that was like, yeah, all right.
That is great.
Yeah,
so
triumph.
You have essentially created a robot orchestra.
Yes.
What can possibly be next?
Different kinds of robot orchestras.
All right.
new instruments. Everything that I've done has been different. And, that's part of the excitement and part of the stress of what I do. It all goes hand in hand. If someone comes to me, and I'm doing a lot of commissioned work these days, it's not all musical robots. I do other kinds of things, other kinds of interactive work. But someone comes to me and, the idea is always different. I'm not just selling a product. I'm not selling the same thing. I'm selling more of a service. It's like, hey, buddy, you want some musical robots, right? usually it's
Like somebody opens a big trench coat and there they all are.
Right. And right, ding, ding. They'll usually find me through the internet, through contacts, whatever.
And we can see examples of your work at singerbots.com?
Yes. Is it correct? Yes. And that's actually kind of my new, I have dubbed my work now, my brand, Singerbots. And I've put my name on it finally because I have this sort of bad habit of going, oh, let me think of a cool name for this project, whatever. And forgetting that my name isn't getting stamped on it. So a lot of a lot of my early work, people didn't necessarily know who was behind it without doing some digging.
Well, it works on a couple levels too. You know, Singer, it's musical. These are Singer bots.
Right. Okay. And I had some marketing help coming to come up with this. And I've got a new logo and a new website and all of that kind of stuff. Because I had a very boring, specifically a very boring LLC company name to sound very generic. So you really didn't, it had art and technology in the name.
Meanwhile, building one of the coolest things on the planet, I think. So yeah, I'm glad you're getting out there.
Well, you know, I created just an LLC, a company that I could do my work under and write contracts under. And I was contracting for Disney Interactive, Disney Imagineering had contracted me to do some interactive work for a few years. And so because a lot of different clients were coming to me and I wanted an entity, a company behind it, I started an LLC. But I didn't really give it a name, really a public name. And then, you know, now that I'm again getting called on to do more musical robot work, and kind of having built a 15-year body of work, I've decided, all right, you know, maybe it's time to stamp my name on it.
There you go.
And, you know, let people know that I'm the guy behind it. I mean, I have had the experience where people have seen me working on this stuff, or I meet someone at a party and they go, what do you do? And I say, I make musical robots. What are those? And it's the cocktail party problem. It's like a much longer explanation than people
want. You should
want.
Make a little one that you can just carry around and be like, here, this is what it's all about.
Well, they're sort of this, and here, watch the video.
There you
right?
go.
But then I've had people go, oh, do you know this guy Pat Metheny? He did something really similar to that. Like, he had this backing band. I go, yeah, I built that.
That's awesome.
And the jaw drops. So you built that? Like, because people have seen it in concert. It was really an amazing thing. I mean, just when I saw it and I saw what he did with it, and it's, you know, it's kind of this thing like being, and I'll call out a famous name, Bob Moog, who's the guy that invented really the most popular early music synthesizers, the ones that got used in early progressive rock. Mm-hmm. And Switched on Bach actually was the most famous early album done on his synthesizers. Bob wasn't necessarily a musician, so he's building these instruments, these new, completely new things that no one has ever heard before or been able to experiment with before. He's sending them out into the world, and then he gets to see what's done with them. And that's the kind of experience that I have with these things, where, you know, I will send them out into the world, and other people will compose for them. We had a space in New York called Lemurplex for several years, where we hosted artist in residence, and they would have 2 months to compose for the instruments, and they were all composing different things. And so then I get that experience of standing back and going, wow, cool, you know, that I would have never thought to do that with my own instrument.
Well, that's other artists then sort of collaborating with your art.
Exactly.
Making more art.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about, isn't it?
It's just like this chemical reaction of bubbling art, right? You just you pour the, you know, my chemical equation, my chemical art into the beaker, and their chemical composition into the beaker, and all of a sudden this, you know, big explosion
that
comes
out. That somehow made me want to take a sip of my martini. That really did.
I need a refill.
A refill. Oh my God, look at this. It's very few guests can drink me under the table, but man, who'd have thought?
I'm doing most of the talking. You can open up the flask there.
I think we will do that. But now our viewers know that if anybody in Pittsburgh is in the market, or anybody anywhere is in the market for a musical robot, you're the guy.
Yes.
Cheers to that, my friend, and to SingerBots. In closing, we would like to once again thank our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Off the Wall Theater, Cefalo's Banquet and Events Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, Arcade Comedy Theater, Downtown, and Bergvavant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. Find out more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. And be sure to follow Pittsburgh's Cultural Talk magazine online. You can find Bergvavant, the It in Pittsburgh, on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribe for free at www.bergvavant.com. This is Brian Edwards saying cheers and good night.